Good morning, everyone. I call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. We do not have a quorum present, so we are going to wait on the approval of the minutes until one more member does come in. But we are doing today a walkthrough of the Health, Finance, and Policy Omnibus, followed by public testimony and discussion. Members have a copy of the DE2 in your amendment in your packets, which reflects the health budget agreement. House File 2435 is not in possession of the Health Committee. Before break, we sent the bill to the Ways and Means, so we will be discussing it on an informational basis only. So we'll start today with a walkthrough of the DE2 from nonpartisan. We'll do the fiscal spreadsheet first from Mr. Joe Harney.
Chair Bierman, members of the committee, in your packets should be a spreadsheet timestamped on the bottom right-hand corner, May 5th, 2025, at 8:28 p.m.
Excuse me, Joe. We do have a quorum now, so we're going to back up just a moment and would ask Representative Ryer for an approval of the minutes from April 10th, 2025.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
We have a motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are adopted, and we will resume with your comments, Mr. Harney.
Chair Bierman, members, high-level overview of the spreadsheet beginning on page one in the House columns on the far right. The committee had a general fund target in fiscal years 26 and 27 of a $50 million cut and a $175 million cut in the tails. You'll see on line 11, the HCAF, with the Healthcare Access Fund target here. Just for members, for transparency for members, the Committee on Ways and Means will adopt a budget resolution later this afternoon when this bill is before that committee that reflects a reduction of the Healthcare Access Fund. And that's because this bill, while it adjusts Minnesota Care and the Healthcare Access Fund and spends money, does not appropriate the base for Minnesota Care, and as such, the net of those two things is results in a decrease to the budget resolution number for Ways and Means. Chair Bierman, members of the committee, that can be shown on line 29 of the spreadsheet, where the 2025 February forecast balance is higher than the governor's in this bill, reflecting the lack of a base appropriation in this bill for Minnesota Care. Line 43, this is a breakdown of the MA impact by subcode in medical assistance. And beginning on lines 52, bleeding over into the second page, are the impacts to the Department of Human Services. The Department of Human Services in this bill has a net cut or savings of $78.073 million in 26 and 27. From the general fund and savings of $200,551,000 in 28 and 29. DHS in this bill has an increase in spending authority from the Healthcare Access Fund totaling $74.7 million in 26 and 27 and $49 million in 28 and 29. Flipping over to page two, beginning with the Department of Health. The net new spending at the Department of Health in this bill is an increase of $874,000 in 26 and 27 and $496,000 in 28 and 29. That amount is inclusive of a general fund cut in 26 and 27 of $3.4 million and in 28 and 29 of $5.1 million. It is also inclusive of additional authority to spend $27,000 in the state government special revenue fund in 26 and 27, and a savings in the state government special revenue fund in 20 and 29 of $36,000. And lastly, at MDH, the net of their total impact includes additional authority out of the Healthcare Access Fund to spend $4.2 million in 26 and 27 and $5.7 in the tails. Chair Bierman, members of the committee, the Health Board's net impact to the general fund is $350,000 in 26 and 27 and $900,000 in the tails. Moving down to the Rare Disease Advisory Council, the net increase to the base for the Rare Disease Advisory Council included in this bill is $701,000 in 26 and 27 and $706,000 in 20 and 29. And lastly, Chair Bierman, members of the committee, the Office of EMS has increased authority to spend out of the general fund $30.4 million in 26 and 27 and $29.1 in 28 and 29. For the sake of brevity for the rest of the changes, I'm going to proceed through the balance of the spreadsheet and just note where items are in and not state the appropriations. The appropriations, again, can be seen in the House columns on the right. Beginning at DHS, the change items here include an extension of the access to audio-only telehealth. It includes technical updates to the FQHC rate methodology. Turning to page 3, the House position includes the governor's request for the uniform administration of non-emergency medical transportation. And the House position in the DE2 reflects on line 435, administrative and grant reduction to a grant at DHS. Line 475, the House position includes enhanced FMAP for current expenditures for family planning services. Turning to page 4, lines 480, the DE2 includes costs related to the certified midwifery bill heard before the committee. Line 484 reflects a $1.84 add-on to the directed pharmacy dispensing payment. More on this later in the spreadsheet. Line 492 reflects a bill heard before the committee for traditional health care practices, House File 1878. Line 501 includes tracking related to House File 1912. Line 506 reflects directed payments for hospitals, House File 2057. Line 515 reflects the tracking related to House File 2557, which changes where the hospital surcharge is deposited in the Treasury in an offset to general fund appropriations. Turning to page 5, line 523, the DE2 includes a repeal of the public option authority and statute and the contingent appropriation made by the 2023 legislature. Line 527 includes House File 2242. This is linked to the directed dispensing payment for pharmacies in that the directed payment is intended to be a bridge to when this provision is in effect beginning approximately in fiscal year 2028. Line 539 is a no-cost item based on amended language in the DE for the CARMA program. Line 554 is a no-cost item related to the delay in the contingent contract with the dental administrator for House File 1934. Line 543 reflects cost related to a 13.68% increase to MA payment rates for ambulance services. Line 552 reflects cost associated to a Minnesota Care offset. These costs are tracked to avoid a negative appropriation to Minnesota Care, which receives no base funding in this bill. And lastly, at the Department of Human Services, on line 556 includes an offset to the Healthcare Access Fund share of medical assistance in the general fund. Chair Bierman, page 6, right at the top, reflects costs tracked in the DE2 for the Department of Health. The DE2 includes appropriations for infectious disease prevention, early detection, and outbreak response. Line 1276 includes a higher than requested operating adjustment at the Minnesota Department of Health. The DE2 includes $8.3 approximately, and 10.7, whereas the governor requested 7.3 and 9.7. Line 1282 and 1284, are no-cost budget-related items tracked in the DE2 from the governor's budget request. Line 1291 and 1293 are the same as the previous two. Line 1295 reflects restoring of funding to local public health cannabis grants. Turning to page 7, turning to page 8, where the DE2 picks up again, are reductions to cannabis prenatal funding. Line 1361 is a reduction to cannabis youth grants. Line 1373 is a reduction to public health infrastructure pilot grants. Line 1377 is a reduction to sexual and reproductive health grants. Line 1381 eliminates the base appropriation authorized in the 2023 legislature for long COVID grants and administrative appropriations. A similar story on line 1385. The amount delimited here is the amount that was authorized in the 2023 legislature for appropriations for an MDH policy to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. Line 1389 is an elimination of alternative practices funding. Turning to page 9 at the top, line 1393 is a reduction to Environmental Health Management Administration. Line 1397 is reflects a TAILS reduction of TAILS elimination of drug overdose grants. Line 1401 reduces the partner engagement and staffing appropriations. Line 1405 reduces collaborative funding for state and outside partners. And now we will get into house files that are included in the DE2 at MDH. Line 1409 are costs tracked for the state government special revenue fund related to house file 1029. Line 1414 are general fund costs tracked for the non-opioid directives authorization, house file 1379. Line 1418 are cost out of the general fund tracked at MDH related to foreign medical school graduate licensing requirements. Line 1422 reflects cost for the one-time cost tracked for the spoken language interpreter work group, house file 2007. Line 1426 reflect a budget neutral item in the DE2 for the requirements of use of hot tubs on certain rental properties. Line 1428 reflects cost of base funding for the dementia services program and its establishment. Chair Bierman, turning to page 9, line 1434, cost tracked from the general fund at the department for grants for opiate antagonists on tribal campuses. Chair Bierman, slight spreadsheet error. It should be house file 853 on line 1439. These are administrative costs of the department tracked for the signs of abuse in infants bill. Line
what was that number again there?
853.
853, thank you.
Line 1442 reflects grants to change the outcome for opioid education. Line 1446 reflect one-time administrative costs to develop and review guidelines for social media mental health warnings. Chair Bierman, that concludes the provisions that the Department of Health included in the DE2. I'll move quickly through the health boards and just talk about House files included and what I understand to be the intent here. The House position intends to fulfill the balance of the requests at the health boards through additional authorized appropriations from the State Government Special Revenue Fund and to offset revenue shortfalls without increasing fees. Page 11, line 1540. Reflect the appropriations tracked for House File 1913, the Foreign Medical School Graduate Licensing Requirements Bill. Line 1568 reflect additional funding for the Medication Repository Program, House File 1103. And that concludes the balance of the health-related boards. Lastly, Chair Bierman, on the last page, page 12, line 1643, includes changes to the Rare Disease Advisory Council, including an increased base adjustment that was requested in House File 1501. And last, at the Office of EMS, there are costs tracked on lines 1650 and 1651 for the Ambulance Operating Deficit Grant Program and the Rural EMS Uncompensated Care Pool Payment Program. And Chair Bierman, that concludes a walkthrough of the DE2 spreadsheet.
Thank you, Mr. Harney. Questions, members? Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is not a question about the spreadsheet. This is a comment about the process here today. So members, when we were here last, as you know, we passed a vehicle bill to Ways and Means because it was third deadline and the bill here was not finished. The agreement here was not finished. At that time, I asked about the process. Now, I want to be really clear here. This is not a criticism of the chairs, because I understand this is a leadership decision. But this is the first time, this is my 11th term in the Minnesota House. This is the very first time I recall sitting on a committee where the committee had no opportunity to mark up a budget bill. This committee has no opportunity, not one of us members who was not sitting in the room making the decisions on this bill has any opportunity here as members of this committee to have an opportunity to amend this bill that is before us. And I just want you to let that sink in. This is obviously not a partisan issue. We are right now a very bipartisan body. This is an issue of whether we as members with individual election certificates have the power to represent our constituencies. This is really a serious thing. And I don't know where this decision came. Or obviously, we're short on time. Clearly, we're short on time. You know, when we have a, if this had been a conference committee, obviously there's no opportunity to mark up that bill. And we would do this process. We would have some kind of informational hearing where we would see what was in the bill. And then, you know, it's going to go to the floor for an up or down vote, and you can talk about it. Obviously, at that point, you can't amend it. This is where we as committee members should have an opportunity to have an impact on this bill, and we do not. And again, I don't think that's the chair's fault. I think this is a decision that was made and given to them, as I have been able to figure out. But I just really want to let people know that. There is a real groupthink problem in this legislature. And we, as members, should never blindly follow our leadership, and we should never just blindly accept decisions that cut us out from actually having impact on the decisions that we make here. So that's all I'm going to say. It is really unfortunate. The public, through us, through our constituents, cannot have an impact on this bill. We will get an up or down vote, unless maybe if we sit on Ways, which I think many of us do not. But that's not the function of the Ways Committee. That is the function of this committee, to be offering amendments to this bill, and we are being denied that opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, for the comments and some very well-stated points. As you mentioned, there's some things in this particular legislature and timing that required this to be an informational-only hearing, and we will welcome amendments on the floor to any bill going forward. Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair. I'd just like to follow up with that, just as we're having these good, frank conversations. When we talk about leadership, what I do remember is when we started session, half of the body decided to follow their leadership and not show up for work for almost 4 weeks. And so I believe, you know, if this is rare, that we wouldn't have had this opportunity to mark things up and had the time, we were here. Half of the body was here to get to work and get to it. So when we talk about this, I also want to be honest and frank. I've never worked ever in my life at any job, and we own a company too, and our employees that show up to work get paid. We've never paid our employees for not showing up to work. So that's another thing to consider as we're going into this. We're all not going to be happy with it, but we were here and ready to do the work, roll up our sleeves, and work in this bipartisan fashion. And I think there's blessings in this session. There's things that we've learned in this session that I'm going to take away and use for the rest of my life. But I also want to put on record that we were here, the Republicans were here to do the work, and we were charged by our election certificates to show up for our people. So I just want to get that on record, too. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. Representative Nadeau. Chair Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for Mr. Harney. Can you walk us through how we track the money? So the chairs were given this thing that we're not going to fund Minnesota Care, and no state dollars. Can you walk through how we track these dollars in this spreadsheet?
Chair Bierman.
Mr. Harney.
Representative Nadeau. So the spreadsheet before you reflects change items only. So in lieu of a base appropriation in Minnesota Care that needs to be appropriated in order for the money to be authorized, the change items here net out to zero in order to avoid a negative appropriation to a program that doesn't have any money in the bill. I think it's an obvious conclusion that the DE2 assumes Minnesota Care exists because it's making changes to it, but as a function of the budget resolution and making this bill in balance to that, without the actual appropriation of Minnesota Care, the budget resolution needs to reflect a lower number than had initially been anticipated when they initially passed it out of Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Harney. I think it's important to note that Minnesota Care will be funded, just not in this bill today. Vice Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, you know, this is usually not the committee where we have these kinds of discussions, and I apologize for that, but I do think that I need to answer Representative Gilman. So first of all, the reason that we, that was not an example of groupthink, the fact that Democrats didn't show up. That was each individual member deciding that we were not going to let Republicans steal power that the voters did not give you. And had we not stayed away and denied quorum for those 3 weeks, your plan, your leadership's plan, and I assume the plan of the members, was going to be to operate as a majority for 2 years while the voters did not give you a majority. So let's be very clear about that. There are two sides to this issue. Secondly, the fact that we're in this position has nothing to do with those 3 weeks. You know, I don't know how long you've been here, but this is something that happens a lot, that we run out of time, and it has to do with the difficulty of reaching an agreement. The two chairs were working, and I think the vice chairs too, were working very hard for a pretty long period of time trying to reach agreement, and the fact that they weren't able to do that until now, and I think there was some help to get to an agreement even, is the problem. It is not a problem of having those 3 weeks when Republicans pretended to be running the legislature illegally, in fact. So let's just put that aside. That is not the issue here today. If you want to make it a partisan issue, I'm talking about a nonpartisan issue that every member who came here to represent their constituency is unable to have any impact on this bill today. Sure, you can do it on the floor. That's not where we're supposed to do our committee work. As we know, the entire body does not have the background that members of this committee get by being on this committee. So it is not a substitute. And I would just say to all of you that if it has any meaning to come and be on a committee and sit here and spend the hours and do the work and listen to the testimony, the impact of having done all that is right now being taken away from all of us.
Thank you, Chair, Chair Liebling. Members, we're going to go back to focusing on the bill itself now and try to get through this. We will have House Research begin with comments on the walkthrough, please. I think Ms. Clarkvist, you'll start. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to start with Article 1 of the DE2 amendment. Article 1 is the Department of Health Finance article, beginning with Section 1. This is from House File 794 and directs the Commissioner of Health to establish a dementia services program. Section 2 is a governor's initiative and modifies the method by which American Indian Health Special Emphasis grants are distributed. Sections 3 and 18 are from House File 2147 and modify requirements.
Mr. Chair, question. I think members are looking for a summary. It is not in your packet. It didn't get printed out. I don't want people to be looking for it because it's nothing against you there. I'm just, it's not in the pack. So just listen.
Thank you, Chair Becker.
Because everybody's looking for it. So.
Okay, my apologies. I should have specified that.
Please proceed, Ms. Clarkus.
Sections 3 and 18 modify requirements for spa pools at certain rental properties. Section 4 is from House File 953 and requires pediatricians to provide primary caregivers of infants with information on signs of physical abuse in infants. Sections 5 and 6 are from House File 1029. And add metachromatic leukodystrophy to the conditions screened for under the newborn screening program. Sections 7 through 10 and 14 through 16 are from House File 1912 and modify hospital license conditions for swing beds at a critical access hospital in Cook County. Section 11 is a governor's initiative and it extends the State Trauma Advisory Council to 2035. Section 12 is a governor's initiative, and it makes permanent the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee. Section 13 is a governor's initiative, and it makes the Maternal and Child Health Advisory Task Force an advisory committee. Section 17 is from House File 2007 and establishes a spoken language healthcare interpreter work group And Section 19 repeals the assessment and monitoring program for long COVID and related conditions. Moving on to Article 2, the Department of Health Policy Article. Sections 1 and 2 are an agency initiative, and these sections allow the Uniform Explanation of Benefits documents to be made available in an electronic format. Sections 3 to 5 are a governor's initiative and modify the circumstances in which notice must be provided and a public hearing must be held before a hospital closure or modification of operations. Moving on to Article 3, this is the Health Licensing Board's article. Sections 1 through 3 are from House File 1913, and these establish limited licensure for graduates of foreign medical schools and provide for the practice of medicine under a limited license. Sections 4 through 27, 30, and 31 are from House File 1010. These establish requirements for licensure of certified midwives and provide for medical assistance coverage of services provided by a licensed certified midwife. And sections 28 and 29 are from House File 1103, and these make changes to the medication repository program. And now I'll move to Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Ms. Clarkvist. And Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start with Article 4, which is the pharmacy benefits article. Section 1 is a governor initiative to extend the sunset of the Drug Formulary Committee to June 30th of 2029. And this is also on line 276 of Mr. Harney's spreadsheet. Sections 2 through 5 all come from House File 2242, which directs DHS to select a single state pharmacy benefit manager to process all pharmacy claims for medical assistance enrollees served under managed care. And Section 6 comes from House File 1100. This establishes a directed pharmacy dispensing payment of $1.84 per filled prescription for the MA program for plan year 2026. Moving on to Article 5, which is the healthcare finance article. Sections 1 and 9 are a governor initiative to extend access to audio-only telehealth and MA, Minnesota Care, and private health plans through fiscal year 2028. Sections 2, 7 and 8, 10, 12, and Section 27, paragraph B, are also governor initiatives to authorize a uniform non-emergency medical transportation program for MA and Minnesota Care members. Section 3 is from House File 2557. This redirects the hospital surcharge payments from the state's general fund to the healthcare access fund. So no change to the actual hospital surcharge, just where the money is deposited. Sections 4 and 5, 14 and 17, and 20 and 22 are all from House File 2057. And just if you're looking at the bill, 20 and 22 are actually identical. It's a mistake. I put it in twice. But these sections direct DHS to seek federal approval for an assessment on hospitals and then also a directed payment program for hospitals that participate in MA managed care. Sections 6 and 26 come from House File 1934. This is where it delays implementation of the single dental administrator for MA and Minnesota Care to January 1st of 2028, and also establishes a dental access working group that's a subgroup of the Dental Services Advisory Council, and directs that working group to make recommendations to DHS about contracting with a dental administrator. Section 11 is from House File 715. This increases the MA rates for ambulance services by 13.68%. Section 13 is a governor initiative to clarify MA and Minnesota Care payment rates to FQHCs. Sections 18 and 19, 21 and 23 are all from House File 2955, which establishes a county-administered rural medical assistance, or CARMA, program. Section 24 is from House File 1878. This directs DHS to seek federal approval for MA to cover traditional healthcare practices. Section 25 is a new provision this committee hasn't heard. It came from the Senate. It directs DHS to make the necessary MA systems changes to claim enhanced federal reimbursement for family planning services under MA. Section 27, just paragraph A, is from House File 27, and this repeals the Commissioner of Commerce's authority to seek federal approval to implement a public option in the state. And I will turn it back to Ms. Clarkquist.
Thank you, Ms. Mock. Ms. Clarkquist?
Mr. Chairman and members, moving on to Article 6, this is the Office of Emergency Medical Services. Section 1 is House File 337. It establishes an ambulance operating deficit grant program at the Office of EMS. And Section 2 is House File 696. It establishes a rural EMS uncompensated care pool payment program at the Office of EMS. Article 7 is the miscellaneous article. In this article, sections 1 and 7 are from House File 862. These provide for a supply of opiate antagonists at post-secondary education institutions and authorize administration of these opiate antagonists. Sections 2 through 6 are from House File 1379. These authorize the use of non-opioid directives. And sections 8 and 9 are from House File 1289. And these require social media platforms to have a mental health warning label appear when users access the platform and authorize enforcement of this provision. And that's the conclusion of the walkthrough of the language pieces.
Thank you very much, Ms. Clarkquist and Ms. Mock. We'll go next to questions from members regarding the walkthrough for nonpartisan staff, please. Vice Chair Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk a little bit about this mental health warning label? It wasn't a bill that we heard in committee. 325 is a commerce statute. Why is that in this bill?
We did hear that bill informationally at the end of session, and we can go through any more detail on that? So what it does is it directs the Commissioner of Health in this process. Representative comment, Ms. Clarkquist?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nadeau, I would just say that in Subdivision 2, it's on page 116 of the DE. Subdivision 2 of that section directs the Commissioner of Health to develop guidelines for the warning label that must appear. So there is a duty to the Commissioner of Health.
Follow-up?
Yes, and thank you. So the only reason that this is in here is because of the content of the label starting at 116.25. Otherwise, this is a commerce issue, and the Department of Health, in consultation with Commerce, is to develop guidelines for a social media platform with appropriate requirements. So that's the only reason that it's here, is that the Commerce Commissioner and the Health Commissioner are going to develop guidelines together.
Correct.
Thank you.
Seeing no more questions, we will proceed to testimony. And first up will be the Commissioners of the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services. And if you could state your name and proceed.
Good morning, Brooke Cunningham, Commissioner of Health. Chair Backer, Chair Bierman, and members of the committee, I'm grateful to be before you this morning to briefly speak about the bill and the challenges that MDH is facing. I know the budget forecast poses challenges for us all, and I want to highlight some of MDH's priorities included in this bill. I also want to acknowledge the reality of the fiscal situation that our state is facing. While we never want to see cuts to our funding, We do understand the challenges of producing a balanced budget. In producing the governor's revised budget, MDH tried to take a thoughtful approach to propose reductions, and my understanding is that you two have worked hard to find reductions that don't undermine public health. But first, I do want to address the challenges, the very real challenges that the federal cuts have presented to MDH. As you know, public health has historically been underfunded, and the investments in the past few years have shored up MDH's ability to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. Minnesotans have come to expect and frankly deserve a high-performing public health system. We have been able to provide that largely by winning federal grants. And on March 25th, more than $220 million in previously approved federal funding was cut from MDH, which was destabilizing to the agency, to our partners, to the system of governmental public health, not only in Minnesota, but across the country. This was an unprecedented and unexpected action by the federal government. And while these grants originated during the COVID-19 pandemic, they funded work across our agency, all of which, again, had already been approved by the federal government. It has resulted in layoffs and reductions in services that Minnesotans rely on, including those that support the state's response to infectious disease, including measles, H5N1, and wastewater surveillance, to the state's public health laboratory, and to our community engagement activities. So I very much appreciate this bill's sustained investments in our infectious disease work. These teams that are impacted are highly impacted because the grant, part of these COVID expansion grants, were epidemiology and laboratory COVID expansion grants for all of infectious disease, not just COVID. So when you look at the grant's aims, they were to enhance laboratory, surveillance, informatics, and other workforce capacity. They were to strengthen laboratory testing, again, not just for COVID, but for all infectious disease, to advance electronic data exchange at the public health lab, to improve surveillance and reporting of electronic health data, to use laboratory data to enhance investigation response and prevention, and to coordinate and engage with partners. So again, we really appreciate the funding that you all have supplied in this bill. And as you know, it is but a drop in the bucket as to what was cut. The funding reflects the need for new state investments to backfill federal resources that we knew were ending, and that we unfortunately did not, we were not given the time that we typically have to pivot and find alternative resources. That has historically been the way we've worked in the system, with a strong federal partner, us as a strong state agency, partnering with our local departments of public health and you all's communities. So it has affected us all, so we really appreciate the funding in this bill. Thank you also for the inclusion of the operating adjustment for the department to help us maintain our current service levels. This funding represents support of the talented and dedicated people we have, investments in technology, and allows us to continue the oversight that we want for fiscal stewardship. And finally, I must express my disappointment that none of the agency's user fee proposals were included in this bill. While they are never enjoyable to request, most of the fees in this budget have not been increased in many years, several of them not modified in more than a decade. Without increasing fees, we will experience delays in serving communities, performing mandatory inspections, and providing technical assistance. Together, the revenues generated from these proposals would have allowed us to address backlogs, meet public health needs, and align with the statutory required work that we do at MDH within our SGSR appropriation. My team and I look forward to working with you on this issue and finding some middle ground to ensure that this important work can be funded. Thank you again to Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, and to all of you and your staff for your efforts in creating this bill and for your support of MDH and for public health in Minnesota.
Thank you, Commissioner Cunningham, for being with us today. And as you mentioned, this is pretty historic and unprecedented changes facing the department right now, and we want to work with you going forward. So thank you for being here. Thank you for expressing your thoughts and opinions today. Next up, Commissioner Gandhi from the Department of, from DHS.
Good morning, Chair Bierman, Backer, and members of the House Health Committee. My name is Shireen Gandhi, and I'm serving as temporary commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. On behalf of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, I thank you for your work to improve access to critical health care services. Minnesota's Medicaid program is a cornerstone of the state's health care system, serving roughly 1 in 4 Minnesotans living in every region of the state. Medicaid serves as a lifeline to greater Minnesota providers. It supports the public health infrastructure, hospitals, mental health centers, home care, community clinics, nursing homes, physicians, dentists, and many other healthcare professionals. Developing a budget this season was not an easy task. I commend you for identifying efficiencies in your proposal that address the projected budget deficit, as well as identifying investments that will improve people's lives. I want to extend my gratitude for the inclusion of Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's key budget priorities, including extending access to audio-only telehealth. This investment ensures ongoing access to mental health services as well as preventive care, especially for people in greater Minnesota and younger populations. Restoring the state's ability to manage the preferred drug list by eliminating the sunset on the Drug Formulary Committee. The expiration of the Drug Formulary Committee would result in the loss of supplemental pharmacy rebates. Eliminating the sunset is expected to allow the state to continue claiming the full value of the supplemental pharmacy rebates in years 2028 and 2029. Authorizing uniform administration of non-emergency medical transportation, or NEMT. The current structure of NEMT can make it difficult for members to access transportation services. A uniform program will help reduce administrative complexity and improve enrollees' access to healthcare services. We look forward to continued collaboration with your committee on containing pharmaceutical costs by leveraging increased transparency and administrative efficiencies. Our team will continue to analyze the bill and provide technical assistance. Thank you again for your dedication to supporting access for all individuals to healthcare in Minnesota.
Thank you, Commissioner Gandhi, for being here today and speaking. We too look forward to working with you going forward. Appreciate it. We will now move to testifiers from the public. I'll have Terry Wilder will be first. Suzanne Wheeler will be on deck. If you both want to go to the front, that would be fine. And you can introduce yourselves to the committee, please, and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Terry Wilder, and I'm the chair of InAction Minnesota, one of the state chapters that is part of the national organization InAction. InAction provides support and advocates for people with myalgic encephalomyelitis, often referred to as ME/CFS, as well as long COVID. I'm here today to urge you to protect the funding for long COVID grants and administrative appropriations. Under no circumstances should this funding be eliminated. Long COVID is a serious disease where people continue to experience symptoms like severe fatigue, brain fog, or shortness of breath for 3 months or longer after getting COVID. It's often impacting their ability to work, care for family, or live independently. In 2023, the Minnesota Department of Health conducted a COVID survey with adult Minnesotans with a known COVID-19 infection to learn about their experiences and symptoms. Over 40% of those surveyed had symptoms lasting 3 months or more. Nearly 1 in 5 had severe long-lasting symptoms. And despite this, only 9% were told by their healthcare provider that they may have long COVID. Nationally, just 7% of physicians feel confident diagnosing long COVID, and only 4% feel confident treating it. Long COVID and the comorbidities that come with it isn't rare, and it can be life-altering. Some improve, but many are left unable to work, study, or care for their families. We've seen professors no longer able to teach and doctors unable to practice medicine, forced to leave their careers. Can you imagine how devastating that must be to have your dreams taken away after years of training and education? Minnesota has been a national leader in long COVID, being one of the first state health department programs on long COVID, ME/CFS, and associated diseases. We should be very proud of that. The Minnesota Department of Health, through this long COVID funding, funds 18 trusted community organizations that reach Minnesotans who are disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 and long COVID. This funding also educates healthcare providers in our state so that they can diagnose and provide care to those with the disease. ME Action, the organization I'm affiliated with, is one of those funded organizations. At ME Action, we hear from people every week desperate for help, and we want to respond to them. We want to prevent more people from getting long COVID so they can keep their jobs, raise their children, and live their lives. And for those who are unable to regain employment due to their disability, we want to make sure that they have the home and community-based services they need to live their lives in the best way possible. So I'll end by reminding you that your colleague in the Senate, Senator Lindsey Port, has been open about how long COVID has changed her life. She fought very hard for this funding while ill herself. At a minimum, please honor her leadership and the Minnesotans she represents. Please do not eliminate this funding. It will be devastating to the communities you represent. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Wilder. Good morning. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bakker, Chair Bierman, and committee members. My name is Suzanne Wheeler. I am the former president and co-founder of the Minnesota ME/CFS Alliance, as well as I am a person that has ME/CFS, as Terry said, myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome. Prior to this illness, I was an Army UH-60 Blackhawk helicopter pilot in the late 80s and 90s. Throughout the 90s, I was a regional manager managing 3,500 SEIU Local 26 employees, fitness enthusiast, and a mom. My illness took me to my knees, leaving me homebound, bedridden, severe pain just prior to the long COVID health crisis. It's important to note that approximately 50% of people with long COVID are diagnosed with ME/CFS. And ME/CFS is defined by the World Health Organization as a neurological disease, which impacts multiple body systems. Now, I volunteer as a full-time advocate for people suffering with debilitating effects from this illness. The Minnesota ME/CFS Alliance can receive 4 to 5 emails or calls daily from people whose lives have been destroyed, and those numbers are increasing. These people are desperate for help or resources. The grant funding is critical, and we can't just do this with our small organization at the Minnesota ME/CFS Alliance. We have 1 to 2 people that are working to help individuals. Mostly and first and foremost, we try to help people find doctors and connect them with the few specialists that are available in this state or at a national level. But along with that, we give numerous rides to appointments. We help people pack when getting evicted. We give ideas for managing the extreme post-exertional malaise that leaves people bedridden, often for days, weeks, and even months. I've washed people's clothes, either at my house or theirs. I change their sheets. I find contractors for home repairs. We make coordination calls. We travel in vans to appointments with people who are bedridden, who are unable to speak or even tolerate the slightest amount of light. For those most severely impacted. We push them in wheelchairs. I've even pushed them in gurneys so that they could lay down at the appointments. We mail facts and disability documents for those people, pick up groceries, find food shelf options. We talk for hundreds of hours on the phone with people suffering. We help them find attorneys for disability cases for both corporate short-term, long-term cases and SSI, SSDI, attend those doctor's appointments and be someone who will advocate for them. We help train the caregivers, social services and home health aides in the special needs of people like me. We help provide emergency funds where we can. We performed as the role of medical power of attorneys, and we found our way into psych wards when someone like us was held against their will with this illness. Long COVID is a health crisis, and without this state funding, the resources of the Minnesota Department of Health are inadequate to address the impact in Minnesota. COVID has disproportionately impacted LGBTQ, Black, Indigenous, and other non-white communities, and low-income, rural, disabled, and elder populations. The House Health budget proposes to eliminate all long COVID grants and administration appropriations, as indicated in HF 2435, spreadsheet line 1381, and I urge you to reconsider this action. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wheeler, for your testimony. Next up, we'll have Robert Freeman, followed by Eric Simonson. And please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed.
Good morning, co-chairs and committee members. For the record, my name is Robert Freeman. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy for the Minnesota and North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. On behalf of the more than 102,000 Minnesotans living with Alzheimer's disease or some other form of dementia, and the 166,000 people in Minnesota who are their unpaid caregivers, I want to thank this committee for including funding for Representative Nadeau's bipartisan bill, House File 794 in your omnibus bill, which establishes a dementia services program at the Department of Health. As I testified in this committee previously, up to a third of dementia cases are preventable, yet today there's no single person within state government whose full-time job it is to focus on reducing the incidence of dementia and coordinating services for those whose lives are currently impacted. A dedicated dementia program at MDH will have line of sight into the various programs and funding streams that touch dementia, ensuring better coordination and smarter use of existing resources. Let's join the 29 other states, red and blue, that have already recognized the value of creating a similar program on dementia. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify this morning. Thank you to all of our co-authors, many of whom are sitting in this room. And thank you all for your support of Minnesota families impacted by dementia. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. And next, Mr. Simonson, if you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, and members of the committee. My name is Eric Simonson, and I represent the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. We are an organization of more than 115 cities located outside the seven-county metropolitan area, and we want to comment today favorably on critical provisions relative to rural EMS contained in the DE2 amendment. First, to the Ambulance Operating Deficit Grant Program in Article 6. We recognize that with a challenging budget target, not all priorities can be funded. We very much appreciate the House Committee's support of House File 337, authored by Representative Zeleznikar. The policy and proposed funding in that bill and in the underlying DE2 will help fund this effort across the next two bienniums. This provision is going to make the difference for a lot of struggling ambulance providers across Greater Minnesota. I know many of you have heard story after story of communities having to give up their service because they simply cannot afford to continue operations. Our cities believe in sustainability, and part of that is an expectation that when somebody calls 911 for an ambulance, there is that expectation that someone will come. The provisions in this bill will help to keep that expectation alive, and it will save lives and improve patient outcomes. We also appreciate the proposed increase in medical assistant payment rates for ambulance services. In conjunction with the grants provided through the deficit grant program, this will also help our rural ambulance services who continue to struggle with relatively low reimbursement rates. Excuse me. Lastly, I would thank the committee for recognizing the value of uncompensated care and how it impacts ambulance service across Minnesota. We look forward to continuing to work with the author and the body to maximize the positive impact on those services who need it the most. Members, these policies and accompanying funding will go a long way toward keeping Greater Minnesota Ambulance Services operating. We believe this step is a significant one towards maintaining an adequate rural EMS system, a system that is challenged with financial reimbursements, workforce, aging population, and in certain cases, massive geographical response systems. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Simonson. Next on the list, we have Linda Posen, and then Ben Suborger. Good morning. Please identify yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Linda Posen, and I am a navigator for the pilot program of ME Action that is funded by the Long COVID MDH grant. I am here to address line 1381 in the spreadsheet that eliminates long COVID grants. I am a licensed social worker in the state, a constituent of Representative Knorr in District 60B, and a person living with long COVID. I have seen firsthand how awareness and support for this public health crisis is essential to folks like me being able to participate in working here in Minnesota. If you cut this funding, you will see the impacts on Minnesotans living and working here. I'm also reading this testimony on behalf of a constituent who is not able to be here today, and I apologize if I mispronounce any names. My name is Amy Engebretson, and I am a constituent of Representative Kali Vang Her in St. Paul. I understand that the House of Representatives is considering a bill that would cease appropriations for long COVID funding to the Minnesota Department of Health, including grantees such as ME Action. I am a physician who, until 2020, when I got long COVID, was busy taking care of patients, pregnant patients. I was an active participant in society, a busy mother, and spouse. Now I spend all my time on the couch. Because of the fatigue, I am unable to work, walk, think clearly, or engage in anything like the life I once had, and there are so many others like me. I was lucky, so many others who desperately need services. I was lucky to find a group like ME Action. Without the funding they were promised, they will be unable to provide services to people who so desperately need and deserve them. I so wish that I could be there in person to testify, but because of my severe disability, leaving the house and being in a crowded room is just too difficult. I do hope that you as legislators hear the voices of your constituents and leave this funding in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Posen, for being here today and testifying. Next up, Ben Suborger. Good morning. If you could please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. I'm the advocacy director for ME Action, a national nonprofit advocating for people with ME-CFS and long COVID. Thanks to funding from this legislature, we joined MDH's long COVID grantee network to deliver innovative, patient-driven solutions for those living with long COVID and related conditions. I also speak to you as someone personally affected by a disabling post-viral illness. 20 years ago this month, I caught a virus and never recovered. I didn't know it then, but I had developed myalgic encephalomyelitis, or ME-CFS, a condition closely related to what many now recognize as long COVID. Long COVID may be relatively new to the headlines, but post-viral illness is not. What's new is the scale. COVID-19 has drastically increased the number of people developing chronic, life-altering conditions like ME-CFS. This is not rare. It's a growing public health crisis affecting hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans. If I had received the right information and support early on, I might not be in this wheelchair today. Instead, I had to learn to manage my illness the hard way, without medical guidance, community, or recognition. No one should have to go through this alone. If you cut this funding, you won't make the problem disappear. You'll see more of us in emergency rooms, in homeless shelters, and on suicide prevention lines. You'll lose the expertise of those who knows what works and what doesn't. You can push us into the shadows, but we'll still be here. Maybe not in your schools, in your workplaces, or your places of worship, but we are still here. Minnesota has led the way in helping people with long COVID live healthier, more independent lives. Don't turn your backs now. Don't leave families struggling in the dark when they don't have to. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Schuberger. Next up, we have Tyler Deers and Jesse Betke Gomez, please. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Co-Chair Backer, Co-Chair Bierman, and members of the committee. My name is Tyler Deers. I serve as the Midwest Executive Director for TechNet. We are a technology trade association representing 100 innovative member companies. I am here this morning in opposition to the proposed social media warning labels. While the intent of the provision to protect public health, particularly amongst youth, is commendable, such legislation presents several significant legal, practical, and constitutional issues that ultimately make it a flawed and potentially counterproductive policy. First and foremost, the imposition of warning labels on digital platforms raises First Amendment concerns. Courts have consistently ruled that compelled speech by private companies must meet strict scrutiny and be based on purely factual and uncontroversial information. To better illustrate this, the United States Supreme Court has ruled against broad restrictions on digital speech, such as Brown v. Entertainment Merchants Association, where a law placed restrictions and labeling requirements on the sale or rental of violent video games to minors. Finally, this provision would apply to every social media user, regardless of age, every time they visit a platform, and require that they click an acknowledgement before the user can proceed, not once or at an interval, but every time. Consent fatigue is a well-documented phenomenon. Consumers often ignore ubiquitous cautionary messages, which dilutes their effectiveness. And for these reasons, we ask you not to move forward with this provision at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Deers. And next up, Mr. Jesse Betty Gomez, if you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, sir. My name is Jesse Bethke Gomez. I'm the Executive Director of Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. We are a statutory nonprofit in the federal government, also the state of Minnesota, Minnesota Statute 2688-01, Subdivision 8, Centers for Independent Living. We are also a essential community provider during Executive Order 2020. And I'm also pleased to share with you that during the shelter in place era, that I was able to organize a meeting with FEMA, our good friends at Department of Health, Department of Human Services, to create in-home vaccinations for people who otherwise could not go receive vaccinations. As a Center for Independent Living, 50% of our employees are people with disabilities. At our agency with over 70 employees, 65% are people with disabilities. We're here in support of restoring funding for long COVID and its administration as well. We are funded in long COVID. What I want to share with you is that it is not well known that through an assessment, people with long COVID also qualify for the Americans with Disabilities Act. And Minnesota has the ADA Minnesota program housed by Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. And by the time we are hearing people contact us, they're at wit's end. They often are losing a job. They're having difficulty with housing. I share this with you because many years ago, I was appointed by Governor Tim Pawlenty to, if you recall, the Healthcare Citizens panel, which had U.S. Senator David F. Durenberger, who chaired that. We found ourselves 20 years ago with the need to develop a much better healthcare system. We advocated for things like, if you can believe this, electronic medical records, which seems so remote by today's standards. Why I share this with you is this, is that the next 3 or 4 years, Minnesota has really difficult choices, and I applaud you as elected officials for the great care and concern driven by the commitment to Minnesota's Constitution and the welfare of all within our state. Back then, 20 years ago, we found a way to address issues of uncompensated care by expanding employee pools for risk mitigation for insurance. Right now, we have to really think out of the box for folks in the acuity, severity, and chronicity of all people who reside in Minnesota. Long COVID needs to be on that list of issues that we tackle. I believe it is really important that the funding is restored so that, like MCIL and others who are here to testify, that we further deepen and expand not only our public health ability with the Department of Health and the 87 lead agencies and community providers, but we also think in terms of how do we move forward as a state with the kind of severe cuts that we already see happening in the federal government, with the tough decisions that you have as elected officials. Long COVID, in our view, is a very, very concerning public health phenomenon. You have heard wonderful testimony, and we would urge you to restore the funding and for us to find a way, just like we did 20 years ago. I am concerned without the funding, like 20 years ago, we have really tough decisions that, again, lead to uncompensated care, that lead to greater deficits, and lead to emergency wards. We thought we solved that 20 years ago, and I would urge you to include the funding for the long COVID group. Thank you so much.
Thank you for adding your voice to the issue, Mr. Bethke-Gomez. Next up, we have Mary Krinke and Dr. Mann. Good morning. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Great. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I just want to take a quick minute to say thank you to the committee and for many of you around the table for helping to include the Hospital Association's directed payment program. When we started this legislative session, we shared with many of you all that 40% of the hospitals in the state last year had negative operating margins. And we know that this portion of the bill, the directed payment program, has many hurdles to overcome in Washington, D.C., and we'll have to do some federal advocacy work as well. But I just want to say thank you all for including that provision in the bill. It is a lifeline for hospitals, and we need to move forward with every lifeline we can find and avoid all cuts, if possible, to medical assistance payments for hospitals. I just want to take a quick minute to particularly thank two individuals who are in the room. 11 days ago at 2:15 in the morning on a Friday night or early Saturday morning, we received a lot of technical assistance from DHS, and Christy Grom, who's in the room here with DHS, has worked around the clock with the staff at DHS. This is a very technical issue with many provisions that have to meet certain criteria, and so I just want to thank the DHS staff for really putting a lot of time and effort into this. And the second person I want to thank is Annie Mock, who took that technical assistance and put it into legislative language. We are so lucky to have terrific staff who, when they see a concept and know the idea, they can put it into legislative language. So we are very grateful for this inclusion in the bill, and I just want to thank everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for the testimony and for the thank yous. I know they appreciate it, and we all appreciate their work as well. Dr. Mann, it was next up. Good morning. Please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Hello. Thank you, Chair Bierman and members of this committee. My name is Dr. Rowan Mann. I'm a pharmacist and volunteer today representing Roundtable RX, Minnesota's Medication Repository Program. First, I want to make sure to express my deep gratitude for your support of Roundtable RX and including us in this bill. And I want to just say Roundtable RX solves two problems at once. We are preventing good medications from going to waste and getting them to Minnesotans who couldn't afford them otherwise. Since our launch, we've redistributed nearly 2 million worth of medications reaching rural and underserved communities where access is often the hardest. Roundtable Rx is a lifeline, a stopgap for patients who have nowhere else to turn. While we're not meant to be a permanent solution, the reality is that for many right now, we're the only thing standing between them and their meds. Our patients are managing diabetes, heart disease, and cancer, and we've had them testify to us that without Roundtable Rx, they just would have gone without those meds entirely. Your support has made this possible. With it, we've grown every year, and with your continued partnership, we'll do even more. And I just want to thank you so much for believing in this work and that we're going to be continuing to reduce medication waste and helping keep Minnesota's healthy. So thank you so much for your support.
And if there thank you for testifying, and thank you for your continued work in this area. Appreciate it. That concludes the people who have signed up to testify. Anybody else in the room wish to testify that has not? Seeing none, we will now move to member discussion of the DE2. And Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. When Ms. Krinke was testifying, I just wanted to see, ask Mr. Harney, is that on this, does that show up on the spreadsheet someplace, or where would it be?
2057.
Chair Bierman, Representative Liebling, the provision is on line 506 of the spreadsheet.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes.
Thank you. Charlie, so, Mr. Harney, from what I'm understanding here, it has no net. Am I reading this right? It has no net impact on the budget. Yes, he's nodding. Yes. Okay. And then I was going to ask or just bring up the point that there was just an article in the New York Times that Congress is actually looking at this very thing. This is one of the programs that they're directly examining to whether to stop this from happening. So I guess it's good that it doesn't impact the budget. That was going to be kind of my first question, if this was a building block of this budget. But so I guess I won't ask that question because it won't have an impact on our budget. But just to flag that this is a real threat to, I think we all know that at least some of our hospitals are financially fragile. And this has a real potential to at least stop us from trying to support them better.
Thank you for the comments, Chair Liebling. And yeah, that is definitely something. I read the article as well, and it's not the first time that Congress has been thinking about it, but with the current cuts we're seeing at the administration level now, this would be concerning. But I think the fact that there are so many states across the nation, up to 40 using this program, I think that Congress is going to have to think long and hard about eliminating the program. They may pare it back, is probably more likely, but fingers crossed. Good catch. Thank you. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I felt compelled to bring up a comment here. I know I am one of the only tech folks in the room right now. I just wanted to say, to speak in support of the provisions around the labeling for social media. It's no secret in this room that I have been working for some time on legislation to address these harms directly. And we've struggled with that issue. And while labels are not certainly the path that I would take first, they are a first step. But more importantly, having a way for us to work with the teams who actually develop software to address the harms to children and the front end in the design program to design better, safer products for children makes good sense. But the industry continues to fight that. I just want to say also that for members in the room who are not aware, that TechNet does not represent the views of all of its members. And I know that they disagree with the stance that they often take on harm to children in specific, because I've spoken to many of those industry leaders privately on my own. And I just want to say also, to close this out here, and I don't want to go too far into this. Number one, the harms to social media often go well beyond minors. But the purpose of this legislation restricts itself to that. However, I also want to be very clear that social media companies, technical companies, and I am a tech evangelist, need to be responsible in the way they develop their products. The products they design do not give them a license to harm. And they do not get to hide behind Section 230. What often happens, and for those in this room who are not aware, the first section talks about free speech. But the important part, the intent behind Section 230, comes in the next paragraph. And it talks about how we address the potential harms to humanity and society and how we have an obligation to do that. And whenever these articles come forward or these letters come forward, they only talk about the first part and they skip the entire point of Section 230. And so I just want to be very clear that while labels may not be the end-all be-all to protect children online, they are a first step. And I would suggest for the members of TechNet and to anyone else listening to this that they start talking about how we better address how we design better, safer products for children to prevent the harm before it's done. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. We appreciate your comments in this area always. Your expertise is what we look to up here, and we have a lot of work to do in this area in protecting children and others from issues regarding social media. Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. I would love to see, what did the testifier, I think, did you say Mr. Deers?
Mr. Deers, yes.
Is he gone?
Mr. Tyler Deers. You want him to come back up?
Oh, yeah, if he's available, unless he's not here. It's okay.
Mr. Deers seems to have departed.
Okay. Well, maybe I could even ask Representative Bonner if she would yield for a question. Just around the social media piece.
Representative Bonner, certainly it's on topic, and if she's willing.
Because expertise in this area. So when I look at House File 1289, I just heard you mention like children a lot in this. This is like a start, but from my understanding, when I look at this, when I look at this bill that's included in here, it doesn't just list minors; it's for adults as well. So if I were to go on YouTube, which I love to do, to go watch my son or my boys that play college football. Would YouTube be considered a social media platform that I would have to always be clicking out if I want to go watch them and in their football games, that kind of thing?
Representative Bonner.
I would have to study the re-look at the bill language to be specific on that point because it's not my bill. But I will say that it's important to note here that the effects that we see across social media platforms and some of the harmful effects are not limited to children. And internal research from many of these companies shows the harms that are being created internally. They have that data, they have that, so quite frankly, that means that it would not be limited to children. However, I know most of the emphasis in recent years has been around children. There is good evidence that suggests that adults are also impacted. YouTube could be also considered a social media platform, that is true. I know YouTube has taken steps in recent years to try to mitigate harms to children and adults, to be fair. And so certainly that is also a consideration. I know that what I said was that I don't know that warning labels are my preference. Mm-hmm. I think we should build better, smarter products that don't cause harm. But it is a first step, a little bit like putting the warning labels on a cigarette pack. Is it going to stop someone from smoking? Probably not. Would it make them think twice? Perhaps. It is a bit of an education program. So that is all I can tell you about that. Again, it's not my bill, but that's my best attempt to help answer your question.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. And it's a good question, and Representative Gilman, I think it's an informational hearing, and we will find out the answer to that question. It's a good question.
So then, thank you so much, mm-hmm. Chair. Just to follow up to that as well, I know that there is a lot of data out there in regards to screen time, like, and just the dangers of screen time in general. And I didn't bring some of that information with me today for this hearing. But I'd just like to put on record, too, you know, as a parent, I've got five kids. Our youngest, it's very common for kids to get excited about anything, you know, and have community. And what I noticed during 2020, 2021, and even into 2022 a little bit, in Minnesota, what happened with our students that were in school had to shift, and everything had to completely change in their entire lives because decisions were made from the Capitol to close our schools down. So if, you know, there's homeschool families, there's, you know, different things happen. But what happened is the data, the knowledge around screen time and the dangers of screen time, especially with minors, were thrown out the window because all in the name of keeping folks safe. And I'm not trying to be disrespectful to any particular person that was making those calls, but the reality is the last several years, our children have been exposed to more screen time than ever before in Minnesota based on this is the way that you can get your education. So I'm just going to put on record that I'm disappointed that the administration here did do some major damage to our children, disregarding screen time dangers, and now we're going to look at warning labels when it's just even the vast amount of hours that they have to spend to be educated online, and it just is frustrating to me. So I oppose this part of this bill, and I love that we can have dialogue around this and more information around it. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. And one thing we will have more dialogue about is screen time. And I take your point about those years, but I would also point to the development of social media itself, which was a decade earlier where it really hit the fan. And mm-hmm. the impact on kids especially mm-hmm. has been shown worldwide to be pretty dramatic, mm-hmm. not just in Minnesota or the United States, but in the Western world. So that whole development of that has been kind of the hallmark starting point is right about then. But more dialogue to talk about this going forward. Thank you for your comments. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. So looking through the packet of comments from the public, we got to see comments and actually hear comments in particular around the cutting to the long COVID funds. Something else I noticed in the packet, a bit of a trend, is we have letters of organizations disappointed in the cut to the sexual and reproductive health services grant as well. We did not have any testifiers. So looking through the packet, we have folks from Minome and Hubbard, Becker, Ottertail, Wadena counties, local public health associations across the state, Coon Rapids, Worthington, Hopkins, and these different organizations. It might not show on the record, on the video of our committee, so I wanted to lift up that we also are getting that feedback from these communities, that those grants coming from the state and reaching folks across the state from border to border are also being felt in this budget. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Purcell, for mentioning that, and members. There is quite a lot of letters, so it's an assignment for us all to pay attention to them and read through those and see what else came forward, more so than, I mean, there's more here than we had testifiers today. Short notice, I know, informational. We're doing the best we can to get through these days, and everything's compact, I know. But if you can take the time to look at these testifiers, they took the time to write the letters. It's just like your CS. Not seeing any other comments. Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Thank you, Chair. Just wanted to kind of extend my thanks for including the medication repository program. I think Dr. Mann summed it up really well, just the impact that they're having across the state, as well as the inclusion of the funding for the Rare Disease Advisory Council. And then last thing, I just want to thank you for the attention to MDH. I think with the federal actions, they're creating and exacerbating our problems with our fragile public health system. So just want to put a plug to continue to focus on attention for them, not only from a public health perspective and like making sure our neighbors are cared for when it comes to listeria and E. coli and other emerging diseases that we might not have found yet or flu, but then also make sure that we keep our frontline workers and the conditions that they're working through, because they'll be feeling the immediate impacts of the cuts as we continue to go on this journey. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemmingson Yeager, for those comments. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. And first, I want to say thank you to the chairs and to the members. The things that are wonderful for the state that are in this bill are protecting ambulance services for, regardless of where you live, visit, or work, that there will be ambulance services to arrive. The non-emergency transportation has been something we've talked about. It's a big issue in greater Minnesota, making sure that we can have a pathway to ensure that that happens, stabilizing the hospitals across the state with this new, it's not new, but allowing a direct payment system that will allow for federal dollars is going to stabilize hospitals that will benefit all Minnesotans. And I want to commend the representative for doing the foreign medical school graduation piece. That's a big issue. I had somebody that had to work for me once as a CNA who was a doctor from another country, and it made zero sense to me. So I want to thank you for doing that. I think that is a great bill. The swing bed language for Greater Minnesota Hospitals Critical Access will allow seniors to be cared for in those capacities. And the pharmacy adjustments were huge to allow our freestanding community pharmacies to be able to serve our communities in the way that we designed. And with that, the biggest concern, and the only concern, not the only, but the biggest concern I have in this language is the MnCare language that's in this. And I'd like to see if the commissioner, I believe MnCare questions would come under the Department of Human Services, if the commissioner is still here.
We do not have the commissioner here. We do have staff, though.
Okay.
Would you like to speak
sure,
to staff?
I'll just make a comment. I mean, my biggest concern with this, however this works out, is this MnCare program is set up and functions for many Minnesotans and those that are here, to my understanding, on green cards, too. And that has been the program before. It's been going on for a while, but it's for farmers, it's for small business owners, it's for people that retire that may collect Social Security at 62, but they're not on Medicare till 65. There's pregnant women, there's, you know, working families, there's just so many classifications that are using this, and I've looked at the income brackets of what it is. They're basically, I think, 138% to 200% of the federal poverty, and this is a big issue. To me and to the state, and my phone's been blowing up. So we have to address this. We have to leave this session understanding that. We cannot strip that from Minnesotans that have the program that has existed. It has to sustain. We changed the rules. You know, that program, we changed it for those that trying to add another group into it. And I think that there's reasons why, for funding reasons, we don't have $600 million to fund illegal immigrants right now with a $6 billion deficit. But Minnesotans are not expecting that the Minnesotans that have been on this are going to be cut in a program at this point in Minnesota. And so I just want to put that on the record, that that is a huge issue that will affect many people in all, across this entire state. And I want that to be strongly considered and fixed before we end the session. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. And as I did mention, that is an issue that still will be coming forward. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in a response to that, as a person who my family and I have been on Minnesota Care as farmers, as a pregnant person, as a working family, regardless of what your background is or how long you've been in this country, you deserve that. So I was like emphatically nodding with you three quarters of the way through that, Representative Zeleznikar, because I do believe that people deserve dignity and health insurance the way our system is set up right now, regardless of what their status is. And all of those categories that you listed apply to people who might be citizens, might be green card holders, may not be green card holders. And so that's the worldview I come from, and that health insurance was really important for my family as we started a small business and we started a farm and we started our family at the same time. And I don't want to take that away from anyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Purcello. Chair Liebling.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just have to add to that because, you know, I believe there actually is a lot of waste in our public health care programs, but it's not where you think the waste is. I think the waste in our public health care programs is that we run them through private insurance companies. And you don't do that for free. We're not paying for, mostly we're not paying for healthcare service, we're paying for insurance products. And when, for example, everyone on this committee, I think, understands that most of our public health programs, our public health care programs, are run through a capitated system that we pay the insurance companies a set amount per person, and then whether that person gets a bunch of health care or none, we're paying that amount of money because they're on our program. This has never been fully accounted for, and I think there's a lot of reason to believe that we waste many, many, many millions of dollars on that. This bill actually takes us backwards in that respect, and so this idea that when we're covering people that we're wasting money, no. Covering people is providing or giving health care to people in Minnesota is a benefit to all of us, even if it's not our very own health care. I really believe that because we can't be healthy in isolation. We need to have healthy communities, and that means everybody. You know, one person gets an infectious disease, they give it to other people. That's just the way it works. But the way we administer our health care programs is incredibly wasteful. There are millions and millions of dollars that we could be recapping and redirecting toward other uses, maybe actually toward providing actual health care for people, that we are not. So you're going to hear this speech from me if you're here any length of time. You've heard it many times before. You're going to hear it many times in the future. This bill takes us completely the wrong direction.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Vice Chair Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the work that you and, Chair Backer did on this bill. You know, the discussion that we're having right now is the basis of the challenge that this committee had in trying to negotiate a bill. There's a lot in here that is really good. There's a lot in here that each side doesn't like. But as we try to envision and what our healthcare delivery system looks like in 2050, Representative Liebling has one idea, and we all have different ideas. None of them are completely right, and probably none of them are completely wrong. But where we're faced today, and I will defend the plans here for a second, we put into Representative Purcell, the more people we add to our public programs without paying for it, drives down access, drives down care, increases, congestion in our healthcare system, and doesn't ultimately produce better outcomes. And so we've seen it with the projections on unauthorized non-citizens, and we can all agree that everyone should have access to care. We can do that. But we also have to agree on the economics of our healthcare system. In 2023, our health plans in aggregate lost $572 million just on medical assistance patients. That's just medical assistance, $572 million. in $22 billion in claims, and Representative Liebling and I disagree with this a little bit, but I love our discussions. It's my favorite thing to do down here. There's no one that I prefer to talk to about these issues more than Representative Liebling. But in $22 billion in claims, they made, you know, they lost money. And so we can argue that there's a lot of money out there. We can say that CEO compensation is way too high. Take all the money. Take it all. And it will fuel our system for about a week. All right? We have to find that balance between, you know, our, take our commercial market, for example. I mean, it's 14.2%. It's the market that you were in. It's declining precipitously because we continue to put mandates and care provisions onto our system that honestly that's the only one that applies to, and so everybody's running away from it. And are they running towards single payer? Are they running towards universal care? I don't know. They're going towards self-insurance. You know, that's where they're going now. 27% of our constituents are in self-insured programs. 14% of our population works for the state or county government or local government. You know, 20% are on Medicare. 20% are on Medicaid. You know, so it's that mix that we have to find, and we can't continue to blame either the plans or the providers or the clinicians. They're not the ones that are at fault. We're all in this together. We all have a job to do. And as I sat through as many of the negotiations as the chairs would let me, which was, and I thank you for that, you know, you learn a lot about how do we find that balance. And the biggest thing that I learned is that we all are approaching, we want the same things, we just don't know how to get there. And, you know, and today, I'm glad to hear that Representative Bierman said that Minnesota Care is going to be paid for somewhere. I don't know where. I don't know what mechanism. I haven't been here long enough to know the machinations that we can just do whatever we want. But it's not funded here. Reinsurance is not funded. And we can argue whether or not, you know, that's valuable. And I know that there's people that don't want to fund it. I know there's people that do want to fund it. But ultimately, the fact that we do know that every dollar in high claim, and it's not reinsurance, this is high claims payments. That's what this is. Very, very sick people. The state covers the cost between $50,000 and $250,000. They cover 60% of that cost. These are just high claims. That's all. You know, and that's an investment that I think all of us appreciate. And so as I look at this bill, I am up and down in this thing, and there's some important provisions in this bill. Representative Bonner's, you know, work that she's done for independent pharmacists, that's in this bill. The directed payment program that I've worked on is in this bill. I don't even know if the Trump administration is going to approve it. But it's important that we try, and it's important that we continue to work together. You know, it's important that we sometimes we set those things aside and we actually have to acknowledge, and I always get in trouble for this, but I'm going to say it again, there's economics in healthcare. Mm-hmm. There's costs in healthcare. There's big ones. And so we like to shift who pays. We like to envision that, you know, it's all going to be free. I mean, Representative Keeler has a bill in here that adds cost to MA for services that I think are important. Those are things that we need to look at and make sure that we're paying attention to. But long term, you know, Minnesota costs are higher than any other costs in the country. Our MA per enrollee costs are double that of any other state. And we're kind of in this place where we need to really, we really need to look forward about how do we do this in a reasonable and thoughtful way. And it's going to be hard, but I appreciate the work that has been put into this bill. It's not what everybody likes, I don't think, but I appreciate the work that you guys put into it, and especially you know, House Research, you guys are rock stars. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the comments. This is the best committee to have these conversations. And we, if you stick with it long enough, we will solve the healthcare problem after we try everything else first. So, and I'm kind of disappointed. I thought you liked to talk to me the best. No. All right, good to know. Representative Ryer, Vice Chair Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee, co-chair Backer, Vice Chair's staff. I want to start by saying that when it comes to people who do not have documentation, whether or not we give access to Minnesota Care, as I firmly believe we should, whether or not we find another payment methodology, these are people, and people get sick. And getting sick is expensive. And when people don't have insurance, they don't take due preventive care. They can't. They can't afford it. So something that could be managed easily and inexpensively becomes a problem that is a critical health issue that costs, in some cases, their lives unnecessarily, great hardship on their families. And I think that from my perspective that healthcare is a human right, it's not an economic nice to have, that we should be making a priority of that. And so I'm really proud that we have that. And it's something that we're saying when we budget, you know, it's become a cliche to say a budget is a moral document, but this is a case to me where that is simply completely true. Now, I also want to say that, you know, I spent a lot of years working inside the managed care organization industry, locally and as a consultant to national plans. I understand thoroughly the administrative layers that go in, and it's only become more complex since I was deep in that industry because PBMs have grown and become much more dominant, and there is so much administrative cost that goes into the system and therefore is diverted from care. We have a study going right now to understand the true cost, because it doesn't just cost the providers, it doesn't just cost the people, it also costs employers. Think about how many people that a 3M or a Target hires to administer their medical benefits. There is no added value there. Think about the work that we've been doing around prior authorization, looking at Representative Bonner here. Those are all administrative things, ways we could simplify by going to a single payer system, which I've been a proponent of before I joined the House, but since joining the House too. At the same time, we have to protect the providers in making sure that they have stable funding, especially with the threat coming from the Trump administration, threatening to gut access to Medicaid. And I sincerely hope that cooler heads will prevail in Washington. But in the meantime, looking out for the provider communities and making sure that we can bring whatever modicum of stability we can from the state of Minnesota. So thank you all for being great colleagues and looking forward. We've got a whole nother year of working together. So I guess we'll have more of these great conversations then. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Ryer. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nadeau, as always, for engaging on hard issues. And I guess a few thoughts I had while you were speaking specifically around Minnesota Care and who has access to that. You asked the question, who pays? All of us do. Whether it's, you know, in a budget spreadsheet line item like this, or whether it's people who only feel that they can access healthcare in emergency rooms. When Representative Schultz presented House File 10, that was another packed house and lots of passionate discussion around that. And I remember being a little confounded that not only the hospitals, but also the insurance plans, and also different nonprofits were all on the side saying, that's not a great idea. And I think that that carries over then into the discussion about a bill that's not in front of us. It's not part of this bill, and chairs and leadership continue to work on how we fund MA. I think one of my biggest struggles, we came in the same year, Representative Nadeau, and one of my biggest struggles is how siloed things are in this place. And when I ran my small business, we had three program areas, and one of them didn't make money, one of them broke even, and one of them did make a profit. And we were able to use that, you know, our budget as our moral document, as our guide of our values of saying, that program that didn't make money was still important. And we were able to say, because we think that that's a valuable investment, instead of just looking at that healthcare, you know, costs, there are some things that are worth investing in. And that's where I see this work that we do. I don't sit on the Human Services Committee, but that's another space where there's a lot of work where we're not just talking about dollars. We're talking about quality of life. We're talking about families. All of the folks who came up here who suffer from chronic fatigue but got themselves here today or wrote a letter. Like, that is, we care about their lives. And actually, since our last committee, I was looking through materials that I had saved in my folder. And on February 10th, the commissioner of the Department of Health gave a presentation, talked about for every $1 invested in public health interventions, the median return was $14.30. And I wrote down something that you said, Representative Nadeau, which was, we need to do more than math. And I couldn't agree more with you. And something like investing in our families and our fellow Minnesotans, regardless of their status, that's more than math. And that's for the betterment of all of us in Minnesota, even if you're a person who doesn't care about certain people in our state, not saying that you do, but like, that improves my quality of life too. So I'm really glad that I wrote that down on February 10th, that we need to do more than math. And I think that's a hard thing to do in this place, because we are tasked just in our little corner. Oh, we have to make the dollars and cents work, when it is really quite a bit larger. Larger discussion and larger ledger for the entirety of the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. I think, this is a great conversation, cost of health care. Vice Chair Nadeau, you're absolutely right. It is about economics. And when I read some of the things that the healthcare economist Uwe Reichhardt writes about, he's passed, but he has been a foremost advocate of reforming our system and talking about healthcare in ways that I would encourage all of you to look up what he's written. And he says that the first question you have to ask in designing a healthcare system is, does a poor child, a child from a poor family, deserve the same healthcare as a child of a rich family? And if you answer that question and design a healthcare system appropriately based on that question, a question which most other industrialized countries have already answered, but in the affirmative, and I think that this country has not. So that's something, just food for thought in this interim. Think about that, look into it. And we'll have some interesting reports on cost of healthcare and other system alternatives coming from the Minnesota Department of Health next session. Co-Chair Backer, final thoughts?
Sure. Well, first of all, I do want to thank everybody's, the whole committee. Both sides of the aisle has good ideas, okay? There are things that we don't always agree upon, but I have a lot of good respect for everyone who serves on this committee, tremendous respect for our staff They had to learn backerisms this time. I don't know if that's good or bad, but they had to learn those during negotiation. And also, our chair and the vice chairs have to do. And I do have great respect for called Chair Bierman. Even though we do not agree on several things, we would call each other friends. We would call each other friends. The concern that I have in our healthcare system, it's a fragile system. And as everybody knows, my responsibility outside of this room as a volunteer, so I understand giving care to everybody is important. But when the system goes into car erratic arrest, because we can't afford what we're doing, we pull it, take money from a healthcare access we take care from a healthcare access fund from hardworking Minnesotans who have paid into the system, we have to look at that. So we did good things out of this bill. We invested in EMS. We invested into our hospitals. And Chair Bierman and I, that was our priority. We sat down in December. We agreed on that as a priority. We agreed on EMS. We agreed on pharmacy. Like we've heard, and I agree with Chair Lieben, removing discussion and amendments out of this process is not healthy. We were given direction from the leadership to set aside Minnesota Care. That was not something that I was in favor of, but sometimes when you play on a football team, you don't get to call all the plays. So we did the best that we could with what we had. We really wanted to invest more into the services. And as co-chairman would confirm, him and I had a lot of discussions about that, a lot of discussions between services and the department and so forth. Would like to also see additional cuts with the sexual reproduction grant, but it came down to what it did at the end there. We helped pharmacies, and that was also great because we have too many pharmacy desert. So we did a lot of good things here. We did some things that both sides of the aisle does not like. I totally understand that. But thank you for everybody's work and effort. And please feel free to talk to us as we go through conference, as we go down there, because your opinion matters on both sides of the aisle. So thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Becker. And I will, too, thank the committee. Some new members on this committee, and some of you have been here for a while, and we have the stalwarts like Chair Liebling, who's been an educator for all of us for years, and really, really appreciate that. I just want to thank the staff, starting with Natalie and Hamad, and Caitlin, also Jonathan Cotter, Morgan DeFree, and Jack Dockendorf up here, and you've thanked Annie and Elizabeth and Joe already, so appreciate your hard work. Next, I just wanted to share my top 10 backerisms, if you'll indulge me. No, we'll save that for the floor, maybe. But I just want to say thank you, because this is not an easy committee to serve on, and you've all done really well at it, and I look forward to another year with all of you going forward, and looking forward to this bill moving out of here and getting better as it goes until it's back to the floor after being over to the Senate. So thank you very much for your service today, and we are adjourned.